I want to try and picture it this morning, try to enter into the lives of three women who go to a tomb. It's a Sunday morning, just before sunrise. Three women make their way through quiet streets, carrying spices. The spices are not there for a vindaloo curry or even a laksa. It's for something else. But they are very tired. They've been awake most of the night, not from excitement, not from rehearsal of something they have to present the next day. They're unsettled. They're in grief. Grief does not allow you to sleep. They lost the one they loved, Jesus. And when you lose the one you love, it keeps you up. Your mind goes through loops of its own dark corridors. It's unsettled. It won't rest. And it brings you face to face with the rawest of all questions a human being can ask. Is this all there is? Will I ever see them, touch them, hear them again? Mary Magdalene, the mother of James, Mary the mother of James and Salome, three women who had followed Jesus from Galilee. They stood at the cross, at the foot of the cross, on a Friday afternoon when all the disciples scattered. They sat through Saturday, the Sabbath, the agony of just waiting before they could entomb the body, spice the body and look after it and prepare it, unable to do anything. And now they're walking in the dark, carrying spices to anoint a corpse. I want to begin here this morning because Mark's gospel is not triumphalistic. The sort of energy you get from Mark's gospel is not the sort of energy you might get from, say, 1 Corinthians, where death has been defeated. It's not the normal energy of hope that you find. I want to begin with these three women and their spices because that's the flavour and the tone of Mark 16. This gospel has a different tone. It leaves the audience in tension, sort of hope after death, maybe. The last line is what we're left to be left with after the sermon. And they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. It's an unusual way to finish the gospel. It's good news, right? But they walk away trembling, astonished, fearful, and silent. I want you to think about that for a moment. That is how you often feel at the death of someone you care about deeply. Trembling, seized with fear. Add to that being confronted by an angel from God who tells you something which is seemingly impossible. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they lay him. You may be here this morning. Maybe you were dragged here. Thank you for coming anyway. You want to be here. Thank you again. Or maybe you woke up this morning knowing that you will soon die. You've run your course. You've got the results. And suddenly everything is fragile. And maybe you are asking for the first time, is that it? Is it over now? The final chapter of Mark's gospel deals with that space of grief and the unknown. The hope beyond hope. Something's there, but I'm not sure what it is. So let me read through the text with you and help you to understand what God has to say to us today. So Mark chapter 16 and verse 1. When the Sabbath was past, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Salome, bought spices so they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. And they were saying to one another, who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb? So what Mark's doing here is establishing a continuity of testimony. These are the women who have seen Jesus crucified, witnessed his burial, and now continue on after a Sabbath day's rest to go to the tomb. They're not confused about where they're going. They know exactly which tomb it is. But again, notice the type of grief these women are in. That kind of grief and dread that grieving people know. The love that compels you to go back to a particular place to remember. An open coffin, an empty room, a headstone, or a place that someone loved. That's what we're feeling this morning. Yet at the same time, there's a spring of hope in the text. It's not found in the women, though. They are bewildered. They're shocked. Its narrator, in a very, if you like, poetic way, brings hope to the reader. It's subtle, but you can notice it there. I want you to notice the time frames. When the Sabbath was passed, very early, first day of the week, when the sun had risen. Why so much detail? Why not say the next day they went? There's something going on. He's painting a picture, almost a subtext, if you like, that what we have before us is a new day. All these terms have to deal with a new day. After Sabbath, a new day. Very early, new day. First day of the week, a new period of time. Sun had risen. We might say that, in fact, emphasizing the fact that a new day has dawned. It's the author's incredibly subtle yet incredibly poetic and gentle way of, in a dark cave, seeing light. And we have to sort of feel that as we feel the grief. It's a new day. New chance, something possibly going on. God's mercies are new every morning. That's the feeling we're supposed to get from a Jewish mindset. So they walk towards the tomb, expecting to serve the dead, yet the author quietly tells the reader a new day has already dawned. In the rising of Jesus, God has brought in the dawn of the new creation. The night of death is beginning to lift. A new day has dawned unlike any other in all of human history, without exaggeration. The women don't know this. We know it. They have a different and more pressing question for them. Verse 3 says, who will roll away the stone for us? It's a good question. You go to anoint the body, and there's a massive stone there. Who's going to roll away? Again, I think we can read a little bit of hope here. Because even though they know that they can't roll the stone away, they still go. Why do you go when you have a problem you cannot solve? If not, maybe something's happened. An immovable problem. Yet we'll continue to march on, hoping against hope. That's where you hear in funerals quite often. When the loved one passes away and there are eulogies, people give their speeches with broken hearts. And they try to come to terms with the fact they'll never see, touch, hear, or feel that person again. And they'll say things like what we call the star category. She's up there watching over us. Or the angel category, heaven has a new angel. Or the sleep and peace category, he's now at rest, she's finally at peace. Or the everywhere category, she'll always be with us, he lives on in our hearts and our memories. What they share at that point is not truth, but comfort-driven ideas. The hope that somehow this person continues and is happy even though the body's there before them. But they say these things without thinking upon what basis, nor even asking the question, is it true? And that's the feeling of Ecclesiastes chapter 3. If you read the book of Ecclesiastes, it messes with your head. So I recommend it, but don't recommend it. Okay? He says this, "He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has set eternity in the hearts of man." So we all have a feeling that something is there within us, but the very next line says, "But no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end." It's that sense of maybe something. I know there's eternity there. What is it? I don't know. But it's there. I can't articulate it, but God has placed it there. That hunger to know is real. For us here, the answer's not in view yet, but it's starting to be there in alluding in the text. It's an immovable stone. The day's dawning. We'll march on anyway. The woman in grief in the same position as everyone who has never met the resurrected Jesus. Who will roll the stone away, so to speak? Who will move the immovable object of death itself? Today is the day for you to stop. From the noise of the world, the anxiety of your own heart, the restlessness of not knowing what life's about. Stop. Think about the vague hope that you might have in your heart, that every human being asks. What happens in the day that I die? Where will I be? Today's the day to answer that question. There's not many times in your life you get a chance to do that. Today is that day. As we move on, we will find an answer to that question, one that's historical, reliable, and worthy of your life. So we just had the Spice Girls. We now have the Rolling Stones. Then have the Angels, maybe? For those who are old enough. Verse 4. Looking up, they saw the stone had been rolled away. It was very large. Here the author does something quite remarkable. No detail, straight into it, smack bang. They looked up, stone's been rolled away. We're not told how, when, or why. But we're told in the text that it's what you call a passive thing. That the stone has been rolled away, or had been rolled away. And grammatical stuff, it's what's called God, divine passive. God has rolled the stone away. The author understood that, and now when the angel is about to speak, the women too will start to understand this. It's called the grammar of grace, if you like. The activity of God when humans aren't active. God is already at work here. He has rolled the stone away. Not only that, God has sent a messenger to speak to the women. Verse 5 says, "And entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, dressed in a white robe, and they were alarmed. And he said to them, 'Do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him.'" So they've entered the tomb. I see a young man, the right-hand side, dressed in white, and we understand that to be a messenger from God himself. And the author says the women were alarmed, a profound, overwhelming shock, the kind of terror that stops you in your tracks, and rightly so. You don't see an angel every day. The messenger speaks and makes three statements. He says, "You seek Jesus of Nazareth. The one who is raised is Jesus of Nazareth, the same historical Jesus that you spent years with." In other words, the angel is telling them and telling us today, this is no spiritual idea. This is not a metaphor for hope beyond the grave. This is named a known person from a specific town. Moreover, he was crucified. That means he did die. It's the continuity from the Good Friday, the cross. The one who's crucified, it's the same guy. The guy who died on the cross on Friday, whose nail marks are still in his hands and feet, even to this day in heaven, book of Revelation, he has risen, or more literally, he has been raised. You get that passive idea again. God is active in raising Jesus from the grave. The empty tomb is explained for us by the angel. The body has not been taken by dogs or stolen or it's the wrong tomb. We are told that God has done something. God has raised Jesus from the grave, the crucified one, bodily, historically, and according to what Jesus said would happen. So before they were asked to believe, they were told exactly what has been done. So now it's time for us to stand in their place, the place of the women, looking into the empty tomb. And you've been told that he's been raised. How do you feel? What do you conclude? Cold, dark, empty tomb. Angel speaks, and it's not comforting. It's actually disorientating. Imagine walking in that space. The body you came to anoint is not there. An empty tomb. He has risen. You ought to freak out. And that's what the women do. So let me ask you, is it hard for you then to believe that God raised Jesus from the dead? Why is it so hard to believe? Why? Is it really that hard to believe? I've got to question that. That the God of the universe, who created the universe with a word, surely he can overcome death. And if death comes into the world through sin because we fail God and he judges us and death comes into all of us, surely that the price of sin has been paid, then the chains of death have been broken. Is it really that hard to believe? I actually don't think it is. God says a new day has dawned, and we are now living in the realms of eternity historically. The facts don't change, but the resurrection has changed everything for everyone. And God says to you today, death is not the last word. This is the resurrection. The one who was dead and is now alive. God has not just put eternity in the hearts of man, but brought eternity into human history through the resurrection of Jesus, the breaking of a new dawn. So this vague hope that maybe something is there can now be a confident reality. This is our God. This is what he does. He's for us and not against us. He gives us hope when we have no hope. He comforts our grief. He brings our darkness into light. He turns our mourning into dancing. This is what he does. Before we move on, the angels react, and there's a command there from the angel gives to the women. Verse 7, but go tell the disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. So the angel commands them, go, women, go and tell the disciples about the risen Jesus. But did you notice something else there? A particular name that was mentioned. He's been highlighted. Peter. Why is Peter being highlighted? Well, he's the guy who publicly disowns Jesus, emphatically disowned Jesus publicly, and the one who calls curses upon himself to save his own skin. And they all ran away, but Peter's the one who really dug himself a deep hole. And the angel tells them, tell the disciples and Peter. Not tell the disciples except that guy. Not tell the disciples, we'll deal with Peter later. But Peter by name, Peter he failed. It's got to tell you something about Jesus, hasn't it? Back to the grammar of grace. Peter and you and I who have failed are not left to wonder whether what we have done has disqualified us. Peter is not made to sit in the ashes of his failure until somehow he can prove his worthiness again. Peter is named personally, deliberately, I think even tenderly. The one who denied Jesus three times is not erased from the circle of discipleship. That's hope for you and I. Even if we have denied him before friends and family, today's a new day and a new dawn. God is not ignoring your sin. Peter's denial was real, cowardly and grievous. But grace means that sin is not the last word, but Good Friday is. The risen Jesus moves towards Peter before Peter has done a thing. Guys, that's us. God moving towards us, saying to us, you're not beyond mercy. I've not finished with you yet. Stay and come. We now move to the last line. After being instructed to go and tell the disciples and Peter, we get his very real response from the women in verse 8. And they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had seized them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. When I read this, I was caught a bit by surprise. You know, you get your standard Easter Sunday sermon, positive, positive, positive. Which I was six different responses here, all negative in their response. They fled from the tomb, just like the disciples fled when Jesus was arrested, the same word. They freaked out with trembling and astonishment. These are not acts of faith. We're told they didn't listen to and obey the messenger. Rather than telling Peter and the disciples, they remained silent for a time. And we're told they were afraid. Afraid of what? We don't know, but they were afraid. And what do you make of that response? Again, at first I thought it was unusual. When you think about it, it's very human. I'll try and give you an analogy, an example. Most of us, if asked directly, and I said to you, do you believe in ghosts? We're rational people. What do we say? Hopefully, no. Yet, to be honest, if you're at home at 2 a.m. and you hear footsteps in the hallway, your heart has stopped a little bit. And what happened if your bedroom door opened on its own? You would not be calmly thinking there must be a rational explanation for this. You'd be hightailing it out that door. Why? There's something frightening, a bit irrational, about the line between life and death. Like, ghost stories have gripped human beings across every culture, across every century, because they touch something ancient and gut-wrenching. Terrifying, even, when you think about the line between life and death is one breath. And that if there is a joining between life and death and it's thin, and you see someone that may have crossed that line, you're going to freak out. You're going to try and rationalize it, but you're still going to freak out. Take that 2 a.m. heart-stopping, stomach-dropping feeling, and for the women, multiply by infinite. For these women, we're not encountering some rumor of a ghost. They're building towards dread, a reluctant walk, and find in this gaping darkness of a tomb a messenger of God, blazing white, telling him, Jesus is no ghost, Jesus is no spirit, he's dead and now alive. This same Jesus is risen. If a ghost story unnerves us because it suggests that the dead can linger, the resurrection is infinitely more shattering because we're told now Jesus has won and has crossed over from death to life. Not a whisper from the grave, a conquest. The resurrection is a trumpet sound from the other side. It's no wonder that the women went out, fled from the tomb, trembling, astonished, seized by fear, and said nothing to anyone. It makes sense. They fled in terror. So I want to speak to a couple of people in this room today. Firstly, if you're here carrying a shrinking fear of death or the fear of meaninglessness in life, the fear that your life is running out and you have not figured out what it adds up to, the resurrection is the answer to that fear. Not philosophy, not coping mechanism, an historical answer for you to bet your soul on. Because if Jesus has been raised from the dead, then death is not the last word for any human life. Yes, the brevity of your days is real, but it's not the last word. To those of us who follow Jesus and have domesticated the resurrection, and the women did not make peace with the resurrection. They were undone by it. And so when was the last time that you genuinely allowed the resurrection to disturb you, to unravel you? Because if death has been defeated, the entire logic of self-preservation changes. We are now free to give generously, to love recklessly, and to live for things beyond the slaving of self. Let the resurrection shatter you, cause you to tremble, even bring the fear of God into you, and reassess your life. It's now up to you. And it's interesting that the very last line of Mark's gospel is a conjunction. It's really interesting. It's half a sentence. Half a sentence you can't ignore because it allows you to fill in the gaps. You have three options now. You can ignore it. You can ignore this. You can carry back your spices. Make a good masala curry. You can do that. You can overcome your fear. Trust in Jesus. And eventually, like the women, the story of God's truth will burst out of you. Or you can reject it completely. Say it's a myth. But before you do that, let me ask you, what is the most reasonable explanation? Let me pray.